Today on WXPR, we look at drugs, specifically opioids and other drugs, out of the focus of physicians, law enforcement, health professionals, and the public. The situation has been in the news for several years, most recently President Trump declaring opioids as a national emergency. A major scandal at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Tomah involving the reported overprescribing of addictive pain-reducing medications to veterans was a national news story. Law enforcement has seen an increase in use of an old and deadly drug, heroin, and drugs like fentanyl used to increase the effect. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid 50 times more potent than heroin. Some say as prescription medications either are too expensive or unavailable through legal or illegal means, people turn to heroin, which provides a similar narcotic effect. Locally, several organizations have put an emphasis on public awareness and curbing the use of prescription drugs to deal with patients' medical pain. We are here with several people who work with patients in various ways, and our discussion today is the opioid situation in the North Woods. Drug overdose is the leading cause of accidental death in the U.S. Drug overdoses are the leading cause of death for Americans under 50, and deaths are rising faster than ever, primarily because of opioids. Overdoses killed more people last year than guns or car accidents and are doing so at a faster pace than the HIV epidemic at its peak. In 2015, roughly 2% of deaths, about 1 in 50 in the U.S., were drug-related. But opioids are a key component of modern medicine that have improved the quality of life for millions of people, particularly cancer patients and those with acute pain. But the question remains balancing the positives with the negatives, especially when weighed against the risks of overdose and addiction. I'm Ken Kroll, news director at WXPR Public Radio. We're here in Minocqua. Marshfield Clinic Health Systems provides substance abuse services for people addressing alcohol and other drug abuse. Minocqua Alcohol and Drug Recovery Center, Highway 70 West Minocqua, offers alcohol and other drug abuse services. Their services align with the HOPE Consortium, 12 Wisconsin organizations helping to address alcohol and drug addiction. Today, we bring representatives from several aspects of the opioid situation to this table to talk about what the situation is and what's being done to curb addiction. I'm going to have each of them introduce themselves and what their individual role is, and we'll start with you.
I'm Peter Walker. I'm a care coordinator for the HOPE Consortium and a person in long-term recovery from addiction.
My name's Dottie Moffat, and I'm one of the members of the Partners in the HOPE Consortium, as well as overseeing the HOPE Consortium care coordinators who provide services to people.
And I'm Mike Larson. I'm a psychologist who works primarily with pain management, but I also oversee all opioid prescribing within the Marshfield Clinic system as a whole, and I also work with the HOPE Consortium, and I am the director of diversion prevention for the HOPE Consortium.
Dr. Larson, if you could for a second, I guess, give us a background on what is an opioid?
So an opioid is a specific substance that activates a specific receptor in our body and provides us with a certain effect. And that effect is usually a combination of potentially euphoria, but also pain relief. And so opioids are usually used for treatment of pain. Other names that people typically talk about are narcotics, and that's the way we typically refer to them. And so these opiates, narcotics, or opioids are pain medicines primarily, and that's how they started out. Now, there are other opioids that are abused that are like heroin. That's a different opioid that's not doesn't have any specific medical purpose that we use it for, but it is very similar to the ones that we prescribe in pain management.
And where does it become a problem? It sounds like it works. Those are drugs that work well. What happens when things don't work well?
So what we know about opioids is that they work very well for pain conditions when we use them for a short period of time. Once we start to use them longer term, and we've realized this the past few years, is that the body then adjusts to that medicine and we have to keep increasing the dose. And the more a person is exposed to that opiate, the more likely they are to then have potential problems with addiction or abuse or misuse. And so then we run into the problem, why are we using that medicine if it's not going to necessarily work very well for pain in the long term, but also it may cause other problems with addiction or abuse.
Anyone else have any ideas, any thoughts about the drugs themselves? Dottie, you work with the Hope Consortium. Give us a background on what the Hope Consortium does in this role.
Several years ago, Representative Nygren sponsored legislation, and it's called the HOPE legislation. It stands for Heroin Opiate Prevention Education. And they looked at areas of the state that had a high incidence of overdoses and effects from heroin and prescription drugs. And our region was identified as one of those regions, and that includes Forest, Vilas, Oneida, Price, and Iron counties. So those five counties were identified as a high-risk region. Other areas that were identified were in the northwestern part of the state, Ashland, Bayfield, Douglas County, and then Marinette in the eastern part of the state. The state put out a request for proposals to write a grant to increase this level of services for these high-risk populations. And all of the providers in this area met several different times. We had massive meetings with every single provider in five counties and three tribes and talked about how could we apply for this funding. Well, it was a little too complicated for any one entity to do it. And so Greg from the Family Health Center of Marshfield Clinic offered to take the lead on putting that application together as long as all of these other organizations were willing to partner with it. They didn't want to do it on their own. They wanted to do it as a consortium model in partnership with these other counties and tribes, and so that's what we have, and that was the HOPE Consortium was born out of that, and they were awarded the funding to provide services and increase the level of services to the residents in our county.
Yeah. And one of the things that Dottie and I realized when we had some of those initial meetings with these various treatment entities is that we were all doing okay by ourselves, but we were not blending together all the different treatment resources, and we were all lacking treatment resources mm-hmm. and prevention resources across the counties. So we really had to band together, mm-hmm. and what we have now is a real network across the entire five-county region that are working together very well.
Peter, we haven't heard from you. Tell us about your role.
I am a care coordinator for the HOPE Consortium, so I provide wraparound services for people with opioid use disorder who are receiving services within the five-county region that the HOPE Consortium blankets.
What's a wraparound service? What does that mean?
Wraparound is a service that allows a person receiving services from multiple agencies to meet with the professionals that they work with one-on-one from each agency all at once. So all of these professionals come together and meet with the participant, and then I will facilitate that meeting to help each member of that team, that group, to help fulfill the personally fulfilling rewards and goals of recovery for the individual, the patient, the participant.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get a handle on the scope of the opioid use. Dottie, you mentioned it a little bit, but I think most people sitting at home might not even know there is a problem.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about what all of you have been seeing. Dr. Larson?
Well, I think that there's a massive problem with opioids throughout the nation, and it's not just, we sometimes think it's just related to the medical prescribed opioids, and the thing, and we're saying, oh gosh, we're prescribing too many of these, and so they're getting out on the street. But what we realize is that some of that's happening, so there's some diversion from pain programs and other places, but a lot of it is coming from outside sources. And so we have people bringing in oxycodone from Chicago and Milwaukee and Minneapolis, and it's flooding our area. And then that means that people have access to those medicines to abuse, and once they then get hooked on those medicines, then it's very difficult for them to function. And I think that when we can talk about this more, about the power of that addiction, is that it's once a person becomes addicted, that becomes a focus, and it's very hard for them to focus on other things in their life because they are having withdrawals when they're not on that medicine or drug, and then they need to really search for that much of their day to make sure that they can feed that withdrawal symptom or feel at least normal, because oftentimes they don't necessarily feel high after a while. They just want to feel normal again, and that causes them to really not do well in the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. And I think when we talk about what Peter does and the care coordination from a provider's perspective. We see these people struggling with so many different aspects of their life, and they just don't have a whole lot of support because it's been burned up over the years through the use of the substances. And so what Peter is able to do is bring support around that patient, wrap that person in support so that they can really start to feel that people care, that they can start to see that they have support, and different people come together to really help them get better. And I think it's a really powerful thing.
So the recovery is not a single person trying to deal with it themselves. Is that accurate?
Correct. Yeah, the majority of people that come in with an opioid use disorder need a sense of community and support in order to make substantial changes in their life. And so we find that someone comes in for counseling or something along those lines. Well, there are many aspects of their life where they need to make improvements and make changes. And the counselor or whoever the provider isn't always able to help with that. So by creating the team, we're able to help with a huge array of different things. Sometimes we'll accompany our clients to community activities for the first time. We often advocate for our clients if they are not able to communicate their needs to their providers by themselves, help them apply for different community resources. We can assist with working with the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, so if they'd like to go back to school or pursue some sort of professional endeavor, help with their personal budgeting, connect them with parenting education and resources. All sorts of different things that tend to fall apart when someone is in the throes of an active addiction and may not know how to address once they come into recovery.
How much time does it take? Is each person different? How long does it take before the person gets out of where they are?
That can be a very long time. I also do care coordination for another program that's been in existence for 17 years, and we only serve women with addiction. And the average client is with us for 3 to 3.5 years. And so, first of all, the whole issue of recovery is a lifetime change. It's a lifestyle change. It's everything in their lives has to change, and that doesn't happen overnight. The joke used to be send somebody to treatment and they'll come back cured. There is no cure. This is a lifetime recovery program. So we stay with people as long as they have needs on their plan. So everyone that comes in for care coordination has an assessment done. It's called a strengths and needs assessment. And so we're looking at 12 different domains of their life. Where do they need help? Housing, financial, transportation's a huge issue up here, all of those kinds of things. And then a plan is put together, and people that are involved in those areas are invited to be part of their team. And the client always has the final word on who's on our team. But that team then has a plan of care for that person to help support them in their road to recovery. And that's where the provider may be on that team. We hope that the AOD counselor is on that team. Psychologist may be on that team. Mental health provider could be on that team. Their sister, their mother, anybody providing care to them could be on that team. And they all work together to support that person in recovery.
Oftentimes, the team will act as the support for a participant, that we call them, until they're able to create their own natural support system, their own sort of foundation of recovery. So through helping them achieve their goals, our goal is often to create a sense of self-efficacy so that when maybe they are ready to graduate, they know that if there are goals in the future, as there will be in anyone's life, they can then address them with the natural supports that they've created.
And how long does it take for the drug itself, drugs, to be out of their system? What I'm sensing is that it goes from a physical concern mainly to more of an emotional, mental concern. Am I right on that or not?
Psychosocial. I mean, it's everything in their life, correct? Yeah. The physical detox can occur relatively quickly. In alcohol, it's up to 2 weeks. In drugs, it can be longer. Mm. But it's the rest of rebuilding their life that's the issue. And if that doesn't happen, recovery doesn't happen. Why would people get better if their life is still lousy?
Right. So. Yeah, and I think that one of the things that's really important about what we're doing in the HOPE Consortium is that when we got together and we started to look at the treatment resources across the area, we realized we had We had some AODA counselors. We had some medication providers to help with addiction. But what we didn't have, the care coordination mm-hmm. piece. And that was really the foundation of the HOPE Consortium mm-hmm. is we have to have that person that brings that team together. around that person. So that was the first thing mm-hmm. that we said mm-hmm. is we needed mm-hmm. to match mm-hmm. Dottie's program with the Women's Care mm-hmm. Grant mm-hmm. To really have that within the HOPE Consortium to really tie together all those providers because we definitely need that. Providers are busy. They don't often talk to other providers, and we need that care coordinator to bring everybody together so that we can really focus that energy on that patient and help them get better.
Just some numbers. Last year, and this is for 2016, 131 people, or 84% of the care coordinator referrals were actually seen by a care coordinator. Not everybody follows through, but we had a pretty 84% were actually seen by a care coordinator. That resulted in 270 team meetings and an additional 523 individual contacts or visits. So the care coordinators are actively involved in the people's lives as long as they want them to be. We periodically have some people who either don't want care coordination for a variety of reasons or don't need it. Their lives are still pretty much intact, and so they don't feel that they need it. The breakdown of that, just for purposes, is 45% of them were male, 55% were female. These are the ones we saw in care coordination, not all the people that are seen in treatment. The average age is 30.6. I thought that was an interesting, that's younger than our women's grant. Our women's grant average age is about 37. 62% of them have children under the age of 18, for a total of 213 children living with families that are struggling with addiction. 35% are on probation or parole. 62% acknowledged coming in that they have some mental health issues. And we talk a lot about anxiety. People mask anxiety with many of these drugs. 52% said they were IV drug users. 52% are at risk for Hep C, HIV, all those other kinds of things.
Can you repeat that again? 52% were IV drug users?
52% of the people at referral, before we even get to know them, indicated that they're IV drug users. Mm. Breakdown by county, 37% of them were from Oneida County. 37% of them were from Vilas County. 16% of them were from Forest County. 4% of them were from Iron County, and 7% from Price County. So it gives you a little picture of, that was last year. I have numbers for this year, too, but it's running very similar. The age this year, average age is 31, so we went up a little bit. But otherwise, it's pretty much the same.
Do most of these referrals come in through law enforcement, or they just walk in, or how are the referrals?
They're usually referred to us for care coordination through a provider. So it might be the AODA counselor up in Iron County who sees someone who has an opiate disorder and has other issues going on in their life, like transportation or whatever, and so she'll refer the female counselor up there, might refer them. The majority of our referrals come in through providers. And we've been around long enough that today we had two self-referrals. They heard about us through friends of theirs, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Larson, one of the things that always intrigues me in this issue is that physicians are a part of this too with the prescribing, and at the same time, I know there's been an effort to really at the medical level to look at not prescribing as much as they used to. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it is accurate, and I think that we were really one of the pioneers mm-hmm. in our area. We started in 2011 really focusing on how we were prescribing. And we actually developed a Lakeland Area Drug Abuse Task Force. That involved tribal officials, mm-hmm. Law enforcement, medical providers, treatment providers, and other community organizers to try to get together and address this problem, because we had so many people who were affected by opioid abuse or prescription opioid abuse at the time. Heroin wasn't as common back then. It was mostly they were abusing the prescription medicines. And when we all got together in the room, there was a lot of blame to go around. And the law enforcement was looking at the medical providers, and the medical providers were looking at tribal officials, and everyone was arguing about everything. And quickly we discovered that we had to get past the blame and start to work together. And we actually developed a whole set of initiatives within that first night that really changed the landscape in our area. And we started to work together with tribal officials and law enforcement and medical providers to all do things differently. We developed new policies for emergency rooms, and very quickly we started to see that we were reducing our prescribing naturally. And the police were then coming in and saying, gosh, you guys are doing a good job because we're not seeing your pill bottles.
Now it's heroin.
On the street. But then they did say, now heroin's coming in because the pills are so hard to get. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the unintended consequences is there's always going to be a supply that's willing to come in if there's a demand. And then we really started to focus and learn more about these medicines for pain. And we discovered as we were reducing prescribing, the people actually do really well with chronic pain when they get off of these medicines. We have to remember that these medicines are so powerful on the body that they disrupt what our body does. And when they do that, our body stops participating in our own pain experience and just says, I'll let the drug do it. And so then we become very reliant on the medicine and the ebbs and flows of that medicine. Your pain's going to go up and down. It's not that the pain medicine doesn't work, because the pain person in pain would say, absolutely, when I take my medicine, wow, I feel much better. Pain goes away. But when that medicine drops out of your system, you don't feel well at all because you don't have a body participating. And so what we found is if we gradually get people down off of opioids, even though they may not have an opioid use disorder or an addiction, what we find is that their body starts to participate again, and people actually do amazingly well. We're down in our prescribing by 87% in our pain program at the Minocqua Center since 2011. Marshfield Clinic as a system is down 30% since 2012. We track it very closely. Minocqua Center is down 72% in opioid prescribing. So we're really doing our part at treating pain, but making sure that we're doing it responsibly now, whereas I think in the past, we weren't responsible with it. We were saying, oh, somebody's got pain, we'll give you more medicine, and that was easy to do, much harder to get a person off of pain meds.
I read somewhere that you've developed a state-of-the-art urine drug testing program. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so back in 2003, myself and Dr. Tom Richards, he has since passed, but we developed a urine testing program to help us understand how a person was using the pain medicines that we were prescribing, because the critical thing at the time was we didn't understand what was showing up in the urine versus what they were taking. And we both thought that there should be a way of identifying what dose they must be taking by how much shows up in their urine. And it was a complex problem, but we developed a patented method that allows us to do that now. And we actually, it's used nationwide by another company, but we have used it. We've been able to use it within the HOPE Consortium for the medicines that we prescribe within this group to make sure that if the person's showing signs of either overuse, we can quickly intervene. If they're showing signs of underuse, we can quickly intervene and find out what's going on and try to prevent diversion of that medicine. We can even find things like whether a person has loading their dose right before they come into the visit, meaning they hadn't been taking the full dose and now they're loading it. So what were they doing with the rest of the medicine? Or whether they were running out of their dose. And so we can tell all of those things, and that allows us to really make good decisions and intervene with the patients. Mm-hmm. Because what we know is that if a person's starting to misuse the treatment medicine, we have to intervene quickly and really get on top of that, one, so that they don't hurt themselves or get themselves into a bad spot, but also because we don't want that medicine diverted outside. Now, one of the things we do have, and I want everyone on the radio to understand, is that if a person comes in and dips a film in the urine, we can tell that too. and with certain urine tests, you can't, but with our urine test, we can definitely tell that just like that, and we can correct that problem very quickly.
You're listening to representatives from Marshfield Health Systems. We're talking about opioid here at the Minocqua Alcohol and Drug Recovery Center, Highway 70 West, in Minocqua, Ken Kroll, and the panel. Let's talk a little bit more about the HOPE Consortium. And it came onto the scene, it's growing, and now there's more awareness. Tell us about what some of the plans are for the future.
Well, this will be the first year that we have sponsored a conference, and we wanted a two-day conference in the northern part of the state because otherwise we'll all have to go to Madison to go for it. And so we have the conference coming up August 24th and 25th. It will be held at the conference center at Lac des Flambeaux at the Lake of the Torches Casino. We have an all-star cast of presenters, nationally known speakers. There was a fellow that spoke at the Meth Summit on women and children. I can't remember his name offhand, but we've got him coming. We've got Dr. Larson coming. We've got lots of people and lots of different workshops. There's scholarships available for anyone that's part of the consortium, and that includes the Human Service Center in Rhinelander, Forest County Potawatomi, Forest County Social Services. I mean, all of the providers. There's scholarships. Otherwise, it's only $50 to go for the 2 days. So I would encourage anybody who's interested in this to look on the Marshfield Clinic website because the registration is there. It's being run through UW-Wisconsin, Stevens Point, through their conference center. And we're looking very much forward to it. So that's one of the things on the agenda. We've sponsored some other trainings, but that's our big effort for this year. Going beyond that, as far as what the HOPE Consortium plans to do, we meet at least once a year to develop a training calendar. And that has been partly because of our participants from all these agencies. Everybody wants different types of trainings. One of the big pushes that the state has given to all these certified clinics, and all of our clinics are certified, is what they call evidence-based practices. And there's only a few evidence-based practices that have been very effective in rural areas. And so we've worked to try and bring in some of those evidence-based practices trainings. We're sponsoring trainings on a variety of different issues, and that will be going forward. And our next meeting for that is this fall, and we'll plan our year calendar going forward for that.
How is it different between rural and urban?
Oh, in a rural area, and I can't speak to urban. I'm totally de-urbanized. I'm from Chicago originally, but I would get lost going back to Chicago at this point in time in my life. In a rural area, the biggest issues our people face are housing and transportation. In the city, you can get on a bus and get to the treatment provider. In the city, there's huge apartment buildings where you can probably find something of relatively reasonable rent. Look at the paper and try and find reasonable rent in Minocqua, Wisconsin, and you're really in a hard place to find that. We now have a little bus service that runs around, but it only runs around Minocqua, or it only runs around Rhinelander. So for our Rhinelander participants who are coming here for medication, there's no transportation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, those are issues that the women's grant that I also manage, we've been at it, like I say, 17 years. We have city sites. Milwaukee has a women's grant. Madison has a women's grant. Our worlds are totally different. We laugh because they say, well, we just send them over to the local college and they get all the parenting classes they need. Oh, really? Yeah. Where's our local college? I mean, it's just our lack of resources, I think, is one of the big things. And then the other thing I have to just mention is, we are very poor in the area of childcare. We don't have a lot of childcare, and what you do find is very expensive. And you've got minimum wage jobs, so people are working for their childcare, literally. And if you have a young toddler and a baby, the odds are that that provider cannot take both of them because you can only have so many infants. And my staff, I've had staff that have three children, and two are at one provider, and the baby's at another one. And they charge a dollar an hour or something, a dollar a minute if you're late. I mean, cities don't have as many issues with that as we do. So I would say housing, child care, and transportation are the three key things. And then finances, low-paying jobs. We don't have a lot of industry in the area, as you well know. And so that makes us somewhat different than the urban areas.
And economics plays what you're saying is economics plays a big role.
Huge
in this.
Role, yeah.
Talk about that a little bit more.
Well, if you are, number one, there is a huge connection in recovery with nutrition. There's no way to sugarcoat that. I mean, it's very important for people who get into recovery to start eating right. And if you don't have a whole lot of money, it's hard to go out and buy decent food. And so people live on the, no offense to macaroni and cheese, but you can buy a whole lot of, what, 10 boxes of macaroni and cheese for a buck or something like that. Economics impacts their nutrition, and nutrition impacts their recovery. So, I mean, it's all tied together that way.
Peter, you work with these folks. Are you seeing the same things?
Absolutely, yeah. There are vast disparities in income in our communities, and oftentimes people are so personally impacted by their active addictions that they have a hard time even holding employment for any significant amount of time, whether or not they're using. I have clients that have been in recovery for a year plus who still have a hard time finding and maintaining employment, providing food for themselves and their families. Transportation is a major issue. I would say that almost half of my clients don't have a way to get to their appointments until the day of, and they're scrounging. They're using all of their resources, whether it's their family, their friends, or me. I can tell you how many times a week I get a call saying, hey, I have to be at this appointment in an hour. Can you come get me? And if I can, I try.
Some of our clients, if they have Forward Health or medical assistance, can get transportation for themselves to the appointment, but they can't take their children with. So that plays into
and they can't afford the daycare.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. So I mean, it's so that then you have, and so what happens with providers prior to a lot of us this getting together was people would say, oh, they're non-compliant. They do the three strikes and you're out rule. You miss three appointments, you can't come back. And there are still systems that do that, not realizing that if you don't have transportation, if you don't have any money, I don't care. You're going to really struggle to get to where you need to be. And to penalize people for that just plays into the...
Yeah. Well, that's what we totally see. And then one of the things that we wanted with the HORP Consortium that was so important was tying all those resources together. We're a big geographic area. And given that we only have medication being delivered for treatment of addiction, and that's just one of the treatments. The main treatment is the ODA counseling. We have those spread out across the five counties, but we only have two medication places to receive medications for the addiction or the opioid use disorder, and that's Minocqua and Rhinelander. And so you could be traveling an hour and a half from one of these other locations, and we need people to have transportation. That's where I think the care coordination is so important. Find people those resources and help them get to the appointments.
So are you saying that there is help that could be had if people knew about it?
There's always help. There's no closed door within our HOPE Consortium. Every door is open. You can come to any treatment provider within the five-county region, and they can get you connected into this network. Most of the resources we want to be done in the home area, close to where the patient is, with the AOD counselor right next door to them. And if we can do that, that's great. But if they need medications, they're going to have to travel a longer distance, and that's going to be a struggle for many of these patients.
And the transportation often is the lead issue on a service plan with our clients. I mean, as we put what are the needs that they have, transportation's going to come up, and that's where the team can be helpful. Because you can brainstorm as a team. You and I could sit here all day and try and figure out transportation for Mike, but if we have 10 people sitting here, we have a better chance of finding somebody that can take him or knows of somebody who can or how to get some other resources in his pocket. We also have a population who many have had an alcohol problem prior to the addiction with opiates, so they don't have a driver's license. So, I mean, that adds to the whole issue with the transportation as well, so...
Hmm. When does a person know they have a problem?
Wow, that's a tough question. I think that oftentimes they may not know, or they may get actually pushed into to the treatment by family members, but it's usually when they've hit that rock bottom point and they start to see all the other things in their life going poorly. And I think that we can talk about the problem of an opioid use disorder and how powerful it is in the mind by using a simple example about cravings. And I may have talked to you about cravings before, Ken. One of the things that we heard at a conference one time is a doctor talked about trying to map out cravings so that we could get some perspective on how powerful these medicines are on our bodies and our brains. And what he talked about is if we put kind of volume to cravings, if you go 3 days without eating, your volume of craving is about the size of a softball. If, and I never go without water for that long, so I don't know that, but it has to be pretty severe. If you go 5 days without eating, something I definitely haven't done, then the volume is about the size of a basketball. Now, if a person has a severe opioid use disorder or an addiction to that, they're dependent on that substance. When they don't have that substance, their craving is about the size of a basketball or a baseball field. And so the type of things that we're dealing with are so different than what a normal person understands, a person who doesn't have that opioid use disorder. And Peter could probably comment more on that, about the intensity of that. You think about that. If I didn't have food for 5 days, I can't imagine what I would be doing to get food. And I think that that's one of the problems in the offshoots of an opioid use disorder, is that people are doing really bad things to feed that craving because they have to. They're compelled to.
And it's so difficult to for the average person to be compassionate to that drive and to those actions that are, you know, those illegal or immoral actions that are done to acquire opioids, because they have no frame of reference for what that feeling is. You know, it's not unusual for a person who uses daily to find themselves without any resources, without any way to acquire their drug of choice. And it's not unreasonable for them to then be willing to manipulate and steal, break into families' homes. I mean, do all really anything physically possible in order to acquire their fix, if you will.
So it becomes law enforcement, you know, not only in the drug part of it, but law enforcement. There's burglaries and other types of things that happen.
Right? And that's where the popularity of drug courts has come in, and the research on drug courts, because just putting these people in jail is not the answer. It's, who is it? Your attorney general in Wisconsin says you can't arrest your way out of this problem. Mm-hmm. So the drug courts have a philosophy that as long as they're a nonviolent offender, and their offenses are related to drugs, they have an option of going through drug court, where they're going into counseling, they're going into drug testing, they're going into all of those in a very strict environment for a reduced sentence. And I happen to work with an OWI court, which is a similar thing over in a different county. And in 8 years, we've only had 2 rearrests. And that is the same type of thing that they're seeing in the drug courts, is this: they lock them up for a year, not in prison, but in policies. I mean, we give the law enforcement their names and say, go PBT them anytime your heart desires. I mean, they're tied up real tightly. And so...
What's a PBT?
Breathalyzer.
Okay.
Okay. So they know that they're being watched all the time. And there's the incentive is less jail time, less fines to stay straight. And if they stay straight for at least a year, we got a chance of them staying in recovery. But it takes something like that, and that's where drug courts have come into popularity, because law enforcement found out locking them up was not the answer. These aren't criminal. We do have some with criminal thinking. That's going to always be there. But the majority of these folks are just trying to feed their addiction.
You mentioned it, too, that there's other dependencies sometimes. We were talking opioids here, but many of these people have other dependencies, too, when they come in.
They may have other medications that they really feel like they need. So they may have an anxiolytic medicine because they have anxiety. And obviously, when you're going through withdrawal, then those anxiolytic medicines feel really good and help reduce that withdrawal somewhat, so they can develop a connection with that medicine. Sometimes they can use other medicines like alcohol or stimulants to get a different effect. One of the problems that we're dealing with in our area, and one of the things that Representative Nygren has realized, is we have to expand this from just an opioid treatment to really look at the methamphetamine problem as well, because now we have very pure forms of methamphetamine on the street, very cheap, that are very disruptive, and so people are using that substance, and getting connected to that substance causes a real problem for them.
Meth, I was going to explore that. Are you seeing similar things to opioids?
Yes, very much so. And oftentimes because sometimes we'll use a treatment medicine like Suboxone or buprenorphine with a person who has an opioid use disorder because it will help manage those cravings. It's one aspect of their treatment. And I always have to say this, it's not the most important aspect of their treatment. The AODA counseling and the recovery is really the key component, but the medicine helps manage those cravings so that they can focus their mind on their recovery. But if the person still wants to get high, one of the things that we will see is that they'll use other substances that go into other sides of the body and that aren't blocked by the buprenorphine. So unfortunately, we have people struggling. Well, they're treating the opioid use disorder and they're in AODA counseling and they're getting a medicine for that treatment. But on the other side, they're occasionally using methamphetamine to feel that high, to feel that other thing that they may be missing. And that's a struggle, very difficult one.
Just on numbers, one of our partner counties. For the last eight years, I have tracked the jail inmates in their local jail, primarily for OWIs. How many people are in here for an OWI as a cost savings measure? Because if we can keep them out of jail, it saves the county dollars. And for 8 years, the majority of those people were OWIs. And then I also tracked how many were in there for other drugs. And the average over 8 years was two people per month that were in there for other drugs besides alcohol. In January, that changed. We're running eight. And they're all meth. They're meth, delivery of meth, possession of meth. I mean, it's public knowledge. You can read those reports, and it's almost all meth. They said that's all they're seeing now for the most part. So, yes, we have that in our area.
Where is it coming from?
That one, from what we've heard from the police, it's coming usually through Minneapolis, but it's coming from the Mexican drug cartels. And it's coming in a very pure form, so it can be smoked, which is one of the delivery systems. It can be snorted, but it can also be injected now because it's so pure. And that's unfortunate because that really changes the game. And so we're very concerned about that, and we've seen the number of urine screens that are positive for meth in our treatment program go from one or two a month to now we're getting 15 to 20 a month. And so it's really gone massively up, and people are struggling with that, and there's no medicine that we can use to really block that from being an effective high for them. So then what we have to do is we have to really get back to the core treatment, which is the AODA counseling, and specifically something called the Matrix model, which is it's a very organized group-based treatment model that really focuses in on the methamphetamine
addiction.
It
was developed for meth originally.
Yeah. So we're doing that here, and this is the first area that's being done in the consortium, and we're trying to do a model this fall where we're opening up that matrix model, and then we're going to hopefully be able to show that it's a valuable treatment, and then we can start to spread it out and get more grant dollars to spread it out throughout our county region.
That's one of the things going forward, the matrix model, doing it by telehealth, which no one's done before. One of the issues up here, and again, in a rural area, is Iron County might have one, maybe two people eligible for group. Well, you can't run a group with two people. And that might be one over in Forest County. Well, this model would be putting that counselor would be here at the Minocqua Center, but doing it by telehealth, so each of those spots could have one or two people there, and they'd have a group online. And there is no billing for it because nobody recognizes it yet. This is going to be a pilot. We're just going to do it to see how well it works. Because when you do an ASAM, the criteria of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, we have to use that criteria for placing people into treatment. One of the levels of care is what they call intensive outpatient. We have none because nobody can get a group together because we don't have that many people. So this is one of the things that the HOPE Consortium is trying to do is, by banding together, we may be enough to get enough participants to be able to do a group.
So we have to actually have laws changed.
Yeah, absolutely.
For us to actually bill for a telemedicine group therapy, we actually have to have the state legislature change laws. And so what we're doing this fall is we're doing this pilot that's not being billed for, and seeing how it works. And if we can show that it's effective, then we can change the laws and actually have something that's meaningful for the North Woods. We talked about the urban versus rural. And when we first got together, people were saying, well, we should do the hub and spoke model, which means everybody goes to this big treatment center in the middle of Baltimore, and they get all better there, and then they go out and they get some treatment out, aftercare out here. Well, there's not this big treatment center here. We're too spread out. And so we really had to figure out a different network to work together, and telemedicine is one of the things that we're trying to use as much as we can.
You have the wheel with no spokes, basically. In the time we have left, I want to explore a little bit more about where people can go to get help. Let's talk a little bit more.
These are the cards that have all the members of the consortium on them for where to turn for help, and there's also an 800 number.
No, this is radio. You're holding a card.
Right.
Tell us
because somebody has to read the card, and it's not going to be me because of my voice.
Okay,
somebody read.
So consortium members include the Family Health Center of Marshfield Alcohol and Drug Recovery Services. That is the AODA treatment and medication dispensing location in Minocqua. There is the Forest County Potawatomi AODA Center. That is AODA counseling in Crandon. There's the Iron County Human Service Center in Hurley. There's the Lac-du-Flambeau Chippewa Family Resource Center. There's the Ministry Ascension Behavioral Health Center in Rhinelander, and that includes all sorts of psychiatric, psychological, and AODA services. Options Counseling Services in Koinonia Residential Treatment Center. Price County Health and Human Services in Phillips. Secaugan Chippewa Community Health Clinic in Crandon. And the Human Service Center that serves Forest, Oneida, and Vilas counties. That's in Rhinelander.
So there's services available. It's just getting to them and getting it done.
And you can go to any one of those places, and they can feed you into the treatment resources that you need that may be covered by the grant. And so we do have grant monies that can help certain people that have insurance limitations, may not have coverage for medicines, or may not have coverage for other things. Then we can use grant money from the state to fund that. And we also have a federal grant that does some other things. So we really want to find ways to help people. And if they need help, we'll get them in and we'll figure it out.
And for anybody who's looking to contact the HOPE Consortium or is looking for services in their area, they can call a 24/7 line. That's 1-844-305-4673. That's 1-844-305-4673. Or visit www.hopeconsortium.org.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to give each of you the floor a little bit to kind of talk a little bit about your specific area and what you would hope people would take out of this. Peter, you want to go first?
Sure. I'm Peter Walker. I'm a care coordinator for the HOPE Consortium and a person in long-term recovery from addiction. My hope is for the general public to gain a stronger sense of compassion and empathy for the members of their community that are suffering from substance abuse disorders. These are human beings. These are family members. These are friends. And it might be difficult to understand what drives a person to use substances in order to cope or to do illegal and immoral activities in order to sustain their habit. But there is hope for future. There is hope for change. These people can get better, and there's proof all around you. I think most people would be surprised just how many people in recovery there are around them and just how accessible that community really is if you just take a little bit of time to look for it.
Mm-hmm. Dottie?
My pitch would be, as much as we've done going forward with the HOPE Consortium, I think our next big hurdle to try and do something with our pregnant women. We have no resources right now for women who are pregnant where we can allow them to deliver and teach them how to be moms in a safe environment. I mean, taking the kids away doesn't work. You've just broken up a family for life, where if you keep them together and sponsor them with, I think there's moms out there that would be willing to be mentors. you know, mentorship for a new mom. Everybody who's a new mom goes through the terror of having this infant in their arms for the first time. But a lot of times you have a grandma or a mom or somebody to help you with that. We have women who don't have that. And I think the next thing would be some type of services for our pregnant women to be able to learn how to keep their kids so that they can keep those families together. It always bothers me the number of minor children we have that are affected by our participants, and we really don't have anything for them yet. I think that's our next big hurdle.
And just to go on top of that, Mike Larson with Marship Clinic and the work with this program is that the pregnant, if you are pregnant and you are have an opioid use disorder, we need to treat you very quickly, and we will get you in because that's a critical thing. My pitch point would be a few. Is one, we have to reduce the exposure and the reliance on all of these addictive medicines that we prescribe. And so we have to start to look at medicines not as this thing that can change our lives, but rather a very limited tool that we usually keep in the toolbox and we never pull out. And so we don't want people on benzodiazepines or anxiolytic medicines or on these opioids for very much or very long term, because the more they're exposed to them, the more likely they are to develop a problem. The second thing is to highlight what Peter said, is that we need empathy. Because I think what happens is that people say, there's something wrong with that person, and I'm not going to treat them, or they're doing these behaviors that I don't understand. But we have to understand that those individuals are going through things that most of us can't comprehend. Mm-hmm. And we need to really treat that say, okay, we can help you, we can wrap around you. We know that you've learned a lot of things over the years that have helped keep you safe, and some of those things are going to come out now, but now we have to figure out a way to work with you and get you better and help you get better. And it's tough. I think that I would say to families out there, there is hope, but getting angry with the person probably is not going to get them any closer to treatment. We have to understand that this is a very serious physical problem and a physical dependence, as well as a psychological one, that is difficult for that person to overcome, and it's going to very much influence their behavior. So we need as much help as we can.
I think it's a topic that we probably could go another hour and not hit at all, but our time has drawn to a close. One more time, across the table, who have been our guests today?
Peter Walker, care coordinator with the HOPE Consortium.
Dottie Moffitt, helping out with care coordination.
Dr. Mike Larson, I'm a psychologist and the director of controlled substance policy for Marshfield Clinic, and the diversion prevention director, I guess, for the HOPE Consortium.
And I'm Ken Kroll, and the program continues right now here on WXPR.
This is Sheila Weichs. I'm the director of the Family Health Center, Alcohol and Drug Recovery Center here in Minocqua.
Sheila, let's talk a bit about the program that's coming up.
On August 24th and 25th, this is a conference that is being sponsored by the HOPE Consortium. You may recall that the HOPE grant was awarded to the 5-county, 3-tribal area up here. And we are one of the partners, Family Health Center is, but we have partners across the 5 counties. And what we have done is pulled together a 2-day conference to bring additional education, workshops, and learning opportunities to make them available up here in the Northwoods. So we've got some really very good presenters of a level that you get when you go to state conferences. So the idea was to make it accessible to people and providers that are up here in the Northwoods without having to travel a long distance for some quality education.
We've heard elsewhere in the program about the concerns and the scope of the problem here in the Northwoods. Would this conference and other education be helpful in getting the word out about opioids?
Yes, it would. It also, one of the nice things with this particular conference, it speaks very directly to some things that can be done. So example would be we have information about Narcan. That's the medication that can reverse an opioid overdose and can save lives. And Narcan needs to be out in the communities. It's one of those things that anyone with a minimal of training can use, and it does save lives. So that's available. But we also have a lot of emphasis on efforts to help with recovery. So For instance, we have somebody who'll be there from Step Industries. That is a recovery-based employment group that work out of the Fox River Valley, and they've had great success with people not only getting to recovery, but gaining job skills and becoming very productive members of society. So we are focusing on opioids and treatment, but we're also focusing on recovery and all of those pieces that help a person move into a regular, normal, productive life, because those pieces are all important.
And to this point, do you think your efforts are paying dividends?
Yes, we are seeing people get into recovery. We're seeing people who are getting into full-time jobs, who are getting into stable housing, who are getting back custody of their kids. So, you know, I think it tends to be pretty easy to look at what ends up in the headlines, and what ends up in the headlines are the negative things that happen. So whether it's an overdose or it's a driving under the influence or a crime, those things make the headlines. But when someone's life is coming together, they're working hard on recovery, and they're just living a normal life, that just doesn't get into the headlines. And that's okay, but it's important that we don't forget that part, that as people go into recovery, their lives normalize, the chaos stops, and they become like everybody else, which is what they want to be. They want to be regular folks. We have been really appreciative of the tremendous amount of support there has been as the HOPE Consortium has come together and we've worked to provide services up in this area. There are some very good providers. There's some excellent supports. And we see some people from the communities that are working really hard to get their lives back on track. So it has been a very positive thing being up here and being a part of the HOPE Consortium.
That was Sheila Wykes, Director of Substance Abuse Services for Family Health Center of Marshfield Clinic. Thank you for listening to this program on opioids in the North Woods. With sound engineer Mackenzie Martin, this is Ken Krall.